Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal. The top business headlines for today are ASML warns on tariff uncertainty, logs weak orders. Abbott Labs, profit jumps on gains in nutrition, medical devices. Shipping tycoons discuss separating Panama ports from Hutchinson deal. Major Harley-Davidson shareholder seeks board shakeup. U.S. Bancorp, profit climbs with higher fees, lower costs. Tech, media, and telecom roundup, market talk. Heineken tops revenue view, reaffirms outlook amid tariff concerns. United Airlines tops expectations despite travel demand worries. J&J boosts outlook despite incoming tariff costs. Wise posts higher volume, customer growth. Our first article for today is ASML warns on tariff uncertainty, logs weak orders. Orders for Dutch company semiconductor-making equipment come in below forecasts, by Mauro Oru. ASML reported weaker-than-expected orders for its chip-making machines in the first quarter and warned that President Trump's tariff policies were creating uncertainty for the industry. The Dutch company said Wednesday that while it expects this year and next to be growth years, recent tariff announcements have increased uncertainty in the macro environment, and the situation will remain dynamic for a while. Shares of ASML traded down 5% on the caution and contributed to a wider sell-off in the global chip sector. ASML makes the machines that produce the world's most advanced computer chips, which are used to power artificial intelligence systems. While the company has benefited from the AI boom, demand for machines that make less sophisticated chips found in cars and smartphones has been more sluggish. Overall orders for the first quarter came in at 3.94 billion euros, equivalent to about $4.45 billion, missing analysts' forecasts of 4.84 billion euros. ASML in October slashed its sales forecast for 2025, saying some areas of the semiconductor industry aside from AI were taking longer than expected to recover. The company is forecasting annual sales of between 30 billion and 35 billion euros this year. On Wednesday, Chief Executive Christopher Fouquet said the company could still hit the upper end of its guidance this year if AI demand remains strong, though he cautioned that uncertainty with some customers could take ASML to the lower end of guidance. Some investors have questioned whether business needs to spend huge sums on the most advanced semiconductors. Earlier this year, Chinese AI company DeepSeek said it had developed a model that nearly matched American rivals despite using less sophisticated chips. Trade tensions now pose an additional risk to ASML and others in the chip industry. While Trump exempted some tech products from his reciprocal tariff action, the administration is conducting an investigation that could result in separate industry-specific levies on semiconductors. Finance Chief Roger Dassin said tariffs could hit ASML and the wider semiconductor industry in different ways if Washington were to impose levies on equipment or parts and tools that the company imports into the U.S. Third countries placing tariffs on what ASML ships from the U.S., where it has some manufacturing, is also a scenario that the company is considering, Dassin said. We're very actively working with the entire ecosystem to try and minimize the overall impact, Dassin said. The comments came as ASML reported first quarter sales of 7.74 billion euros, up from 5.25 billion euros a year earlier. Net profit increased to nearly 2.36 billion euros from 1.22 billion euros, beating market expectations. gross margin came in at 54%. For the current quarter, the company expects sales of 7.2 billion to 7.7 billion euros and a gross margin between 50% and 53%, a range it said was wider than usual because of the uncertainty around tariffs. Write to Maru Oru at mauro.oru@wsj.com. Abbott Labs profit jumps on gains in nutrition and medical devices. The healthcare products company revenue rose 4% to $10.36 billion in the quarter, missing analysts' forecasts for $10.41 billion. By Dean Seal. Abbott Labs recorded higher earnings in revenue in the first quarter as strong demand for its nutritional products and medical devices offset weaknesses in other segments. The healthcare products company posted a profit of $1.33 billion, or 76 cents a share, compared with $1.23 billion, or 74 cents a share, in the same period a year earlier. Stripping out one-time items, adjusted earnings were $1.09 a share, 2 cents above the consensus estimate of analysts polled by FactSet. Revenue rose 4% to $10.36 billion, missing analysts' forecasts for $10.41 billion, according to FactSet. The Abbott Park, Illinois-based maker of Pedalyte and pediatric nutrition sales were up 3.2%, while adult nutrition revenue rose 4.4%, citing strong growth for its Glucerna brand and Ensure line of shakes and beverages. Worldwide medical device sales were up almost 10%, led by diabetics care, structural heart, heart failure, and electrophysiology categories. Sales in its global diagnostics division were down 7.2%, but up slightly when excluding revenue from COVID-19 testing products. Core laboratory diagnostics sales were down about 2.3%, which Abbott attributed to volume-based procurement programs in China. Chief Executive Robert Ford said the company has been able to navigate recent macroeconomic uncertainty with a diverse portfolio. Abbott projects adjusted earnings of $1.23 to $1.27 a share for the current quarter. It is maintaining guidance for organic sales to be up 7.5% to 8.5% this year, and for adjusted earnings to hit $5.05 to $5.25 a share. Write to Dean Seal at dean.seal@wsj.com. Shipping tycoons discuss separating Panama ports from Hutchison deal. MSC explores panel parallel tracks for contested Panama Canal ports and rest of deal with BlackRock. By Costas Paris and Jack Pitcher. The billionaires behind the MSC shipping empire are discussing carving out two Panama ports from their $22.8 billion deal to buy dozens of ports from C.K. Hutchison, according to people familiar with the matter. Ganglung Aponte and his son Diego Aponte, the Italian tycoons who control Mediterranean Shipping Company, have held discussions about moving ahead with the bulk of the deal, involving terminals at 41 ports on 5 continents, while disputes over the 2 ports along the Panama Canal are resolved, the people said. The complex and strategic transaction with Hong Kong-based Hutchison has been caught in a political and trade dispute between the U.S. and China. The Apontes worked out with the U.S. asset manager BlackRock on the deal, which has 2 components with different ownership structures, the Panama ports and everything else. The discussions are moving on parallel tracks, the people said, and separating the Panama ports would ultimately require the parties to reach a new agreement. The BlackRock MSC Consortium and Hutchison are in the middle of a 145-day exclusive negotiating window and have yet to sign definitive agreements. BlackRock chief executive Larry Fink said last week that the deal is still being treated as a single transaction that includes the Panamanian ports. It's going to be 9 months of regulatory review, so we'll see how this all plays out. I'm actually pretty optimistic that we'll find a solution, Fink said, at an Economic Club of New York luncheon. Asked if he was confident that solution would include the Panama ports, Fink said, "Yeah, well, as of the moment, yeah." The original deal gave the Aponte's existing ports operator Terminal Investment Limited a 51% stake in the global ports assets, with a 49% stake going to BlackRock entity. That part accounts for most of the assets of the deal, including container terminals in the Netherlands, Germany, Malaysia, and elsewhere. For the two Panama ports, the ownership would be reversed, with 49% going to TIL and 51% going to Global Infrastructure Partners, BlackRock's recently acquired infrastructure arm. That arrangement allowed President Trump to tout the deal as the U.S. regulating control of the Panama terminals. The canal itself is operated by a Panamanian authority. China has objected to Hutchison's sale of its two Panama ports, and Hutchison is facing allegations in Panama of underpaying for the concessions it has owned since the 1990s. These are among the factors why the deal failed to be signed on April 2nd, as the parties initially planned. Outside the Panama ports, the global portion of the transaction appears to face fewer headwinds. The Chinese government has told Hutchison that and TIL that the sale of the global ports was unlikely to be an issue, the people said, though it would still face regulatory reviews in other countries. The deal would make the Aponte's, which through MSC are already the largest box ship owners and hundreds of vessels, also one of the biggest port operators through TIL. They already own dozens of terminals that load and unload box ships from Singapore to Long Beach, California to Saudi Arabia. Some of the people involved in the discussion said the global portion of the transaction could be completed in 3 to 6 months, though the Panama portion of the transaction could take up to a year. Although Fink was the executive who primarily discussed the transaction with the White House, it was Gangli Aponte, 84, who kicked off the discussions with Li Ka-shing, the 96-year-old whose family controls Hutchison, the people said. The two men had informal talks about Hutchison's port assets before the canal dispute came up. They met in Italy and Hong Kong several times in the past, and Li's family were guests at the Aponte's resort near Naples. Write to Costas Paris at costas.paris@wsj.com and Jack Pitcher at jack.pitcher@wsj.com. Major Harley-Davidson shareholders seeks board shakeup. A member of investment firm H Partners resigned from Harley's board earlier this month in preparation for a fight, by Lauren Thomas and John Keelman. A major Harley-Davidson shareholder is fighting to shake up the motorcycle maker's board and quickly replace its chief executive in the face of deteriorating sales. In an open letter Wednesday, investment firm H Partners urged shareholders to remove three long-standing directors from Harley's 8-member board at a coming annual meeting in mid-May. H Partners, which has a roughly 9% stake in Harley, said the company failed nearly every objective in its strategic plan, and that it has become clear to us that meaningful change is necessary at both the board and CEO levels. The Wall Street Journal reported on the investments firm's plans Tuesday. H Partners is calling for Joaquin Zietz to immediately step down as Harley's chief executive and not stand in the way of the company recruiting an external replacement. Zietz also serves as chairman. Harley said last week that it was seeking a new CEO as Zeitz plans to retire after 5 years on the job. Harley said it retained an executive search firm in late 2024 after Zeitz expressed interest in retiring. Zeitz is expected to remain in his position until a successor is chosen. H Partners' Jared Dordeville abruptly resigned from Harley's board earlier this month, arguing in a now-public letter that the motorcycle maker had suffered cultural depletion because of an extensive white-collar work-from-home policy and the departure of several senior leaders, among other concerns. By airing the board's confidential search and publicly campaigning against the company, the board believes Mr. Dordeville is also adversely impacting the CEO search process. The company said in a statement, adding the campaign would impede execution of its strategy and put shareholders' interest at risk. Dordeville, a partner at the firm, joined Harley's board in 2022 as H Partners became what is now Harley's second biggest shareholders. Dordeville said he had been privately calling for the immediate resignation of Zeitz. Harley said that its directors had interviewed three potential CEOs but declined to offer any the role. Zeitz helped boost Harley's profit during his tenure, but sales of the company's bikes have continued to decline as the brand struggles to resonate with the younger generation of riders. Zeitz took over its interim CEO in February 2020 and was given the job permanently a few months later. Through the COVID-19 pandemic, he helped keep the Milwaukee-based company running despite factory closings and supply chain tangles. In recent months, complaints have mounted from the dealers over Zeitz's leadership and Harley's operations, with dealers saying that the company doesn't offer enough for entry-level riders and that they've been loaded up with inventory that isn't selling. Harley shares have lost around 30% of their value since Zeitz became CEO, bringing its market value to around $2.7 billion. The company argues that it is holding up better than its competitors in a power sports market, hurt by high interest rates and low consumer confidence. H Partners is running a so-called withhold the vote campaign targeting Zeitz. Thomas Leinberger, who has been a board member for 17 years, and Sarah Levinson, who has been on board member for 29 years. Harley's bylaws require directors who don't receive more than 50% of votes in an election to tender their resignations. The firm isn't nominating replacement directors. H Partners, based in New York, ran one of the first big withhold-the-vote campaigns in 2015 at the mattress maker Tempur Sealy. The firm has also struck agreements in the past with companies including Six Flags Entertainment and the motor manufacturer Remy International. Write to Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com and John Keelman at john.keelman@wsj.com. Inside Mark Zuckerberg's failed negotiations to end antitrust case. The FTC wanted $30 billion to drop its case. Zuckerberg offered much less and hoped Trump would back him up. By Dana Mattioli, Rebecca Balaus, and Josh Dowsey. Mark Zuckerberg called the head of the Federal Trade Commission in late March with an offer. Meta would pay $450 million to settle a long-running antitrust case that was about to go to trial. The offer was far from the $30 billion that FTC had demanded. It was also a fraction of the value of Instagram and WhatsApp, the two apps Meta had bought and were at the heart of the government's case. On the call, Zuckerberg sounded confident that President Trump would back him up with the FTC, said people familiar with the matter. The billionaire Facebook co-founder had been developing closer ties to Trump. His company donated $1 million to the Trump inauguration and settled a $25 million lawsuit and had been pressing the president in recent weeks to intervene in the monopoly lawsuit. FTC Chairman Andrew Ferguson found the offer not credible and wasn't ready to settle for anything less than $18 billion in a consent decree. As the trial approached, Meta upped its offer to close to $1 billion, the people said, and Zuckerberg led a frenzied lobbying effort to avoid the FTC trial. It wasn't enough. On Monday, the trial kicked off. The FTC called Zuckerberg, who privately expressed reluctance about taking the stand, to testify for 4 hours. Zuckerberg was back on the witness stand Tuesday, where he faced questioning from the FTC lawyer over whether Facebook had paid $1 billion to buy Instagram to neutralize a competitor. Asked if he would have preferred that Facebook's own camera app would have grown faster, Zuckerberg responded, "I guess so, yeah. $1 billion is very expensive." Former FTC chair Lina Khan told the Journal that the company's $450 million settlement offer was delusional. "Mark bought his way out of competing, so I'm not surprised that he thinks he can buy his way out of law enforcement too," said Khan, who was nominated by former President Joe Biden. "His proposed remedy, like his market strategy, is let my illegal monopoly keep monopolizing." Meta spokesman Danny Lever said the company is prepared to win at trial. "We haven't been shy about explaining why it doesn't make sense for the FTC to bring a case to trial that requires it to prove something every 17-year-old in America knows is absurd, that Instagram doesn't compete with TikTok," she said. "We will not commit on an ongoing trial," said Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary. The FTC had initially sued what was then called Facebook in December 2020, in the final weeks of the first Trump administration, accusing the company of buying and freezing out small startups to choke competition. The lawsuit was thrown out by a judge in 2021, and the FTC under Khan presented a more detailed case later that year. The suit accuses Facebook of having mounted a deliberate strategy to eliminate threats to its monopoly. Meta has pushed back on the FTC's charges, saying it competes with several other services, including YouTube and X, and noting that the FTC had cleared the WhatsApp and Instagram deals more than a decade ago. As the trial approached, the two sides had inched closer together. Meta had opened with an offer to make changes to some of its policies. The FTC countered with $30 billion, people familiar with the talks said, a fine that would be an order of magnitude larger than its record. In 2019, the FTC had imposed a $5 billion fine on Meta. At the time, its largest fine ever imposed on a company for violating consumer privacy. A person familiar with Meta's position in the latest negotiations said the company's offers reflected how weak the company believes the FTC's case to be. In recent months, Zuckerberg and his top aides have repeatedly met with Trump, White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, and other administration officials. White House aides say Meta has been relentless in trying to get the case dropped, bringing in a group of officials beyond Zuckerberg that include Meta Chief Global Affairs Officer Joel Kaplan, head of the U.S. Public Policy, Kevin Martin, and Brian Baker, Zuckerberg's outside political advisor. Zuckerberg himself visited the White House 3 times this year. Trump various points appeared more open to striking a deal with Meta and Zuckerberg, directing staff to work on a deal and asking questions about how a settlement would work, according to people familiar with the matter. But Trump was also getting an earful from the other side. On April 8th, the new FTC chair, Ferguson, held a meeting with the president at the Oval Office to discuss the matter. Also present at the meeting were Gail Slater, the head of the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, Mike Davis, one of the key antitrust advisors to Trump, Wiles, and Ferguson chief of staff. At the meeting, earlier reported by Semaphore, a group made its case for Trump not to intervene on Meta's behalf and to let the case go to trial. It got Trump's blessing to go to trial during the meeting, said one of the people. For Zuckerberg, who has spent tens of millions in recent years aiming to rebuild his relationship with Trump, the failure to reach a deal pre-trial suggests he isn't getting much return on his investment. Some people around Trump have warned the president that Zuckerberg's MAGA rebrand is disingenuous. In the fall of 2021, Zuckerberg and his wife hired Baker, a Republican strategist, to explain to Trump aides and Republican officials that the $400 million the pair had given for election infrastructure in 2020 hadn't been used for partisan purposes. Conservatives had alleged the spending was used to bolster turnout on the left, a claim that Zuckerberg and election officials denied. After the assassination attempt on Trump, Zuckerberg publicly praised the candidate's response as a badass, and the two spoke by phone. He traveled to Mar-a-Lago twice after the election, including for a dinner with Trump, and attended the inauguration in January, directing Meta to give $1 million to Trump's inaugural fund. That month, Meta also paid $25 million to settle a lawsuit that Trump had brought years earlier over the platform's suspension of his account. Zuckerberg also made changes to the company that conservatives have long sought, including dialing back its content moderation policies. The MAGA wing of GOP has continued to criticize Meta and Zuckerberg and has blamed the company for Trump's 2020 election loss. In an interview on Fox Business the morning the trial kicked off, Ferguson nodded to that line of the attack. Meta's acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp had given the company a tremendous amount of power, power we all saw on full display in 2020, he said. And also, that's what this case is about addressing the power of Meta and making sure that the situation we had in 2020 can never arise again. Write to Dana Mattioli at dana.mattioli@wsj.com, Rebecca Ballhaus at rebecca.ballhaus@wsj.com, and Josh Dowsey at joshua.dowsey@wsj.com. Big banks alarmed after their regulator gets hacked. J.P. Morgan and other financial institutions have curbed some electronics information sharing with the OCC. By Dylan Tokar. Some of the U.S.'s largest banks have pulled back from some electronic information sharing with a key bank regulator after it disclosed a major cyber attack earlier this month. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Bank of New York Mellon are seeking other ways to send sensitive information to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency due to concerns around an email hack that is still under investigation, according to people familiar with the matter. Banks have expressed alarm about the breach and the OCC's communication and slow response to the incident, the people said. That has led some of them to hit pause on certain forms of electronic information sharing, while others have been in discussion with the OCC about secure alternatives for sending information. The OCC posted a notice about the hack on its website in February, but didn't proactively notify banks about the incident. People familiar with the matter said some of the banks didn't learn about the hack until media reports. The OCC earlier this month said the attack targeted its email system and was discovered after the agency noticed unusual interactions between an administrative account and OCC user mailboxes. The agency is conducting an independent third-party assessment of the incident, including a review of the compromised email messages. The OCC said it is keeping banks informed of the investigation's progress. The banks who have been pulled back from sharing information electronically are still largely in the dark about what information may have been disclosed to hackers. The agency is being led on a temporary basis by Rodney Hood, who served as chair of the regulatory agency overseeing credit unions in Trump's first administration. Bloomberg earlier reported on the bank's reaction. Trump administration officials have said they would want to make major changes at the OCC and other banking regulators, including by consolidating some of the agencies or forcing more coordination between them. In February, the White House issued an executive order that, if implemented, would remove some of the independence traditionally offered at OCC and other banking regulators. In a speech last month, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said he intended to play a leadership role in banking regulation. "We need our financial regulators singing in unison from the same song sheet," Bessent said. Write to Dylan Toker at dylan.toker@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. USDA is fast-tracking requests to yank soda from food stamps program. Arkansas, Indiana are among the first states in line to add restrictions. By Laura Cooper, Christina Peterson, and Josh Dowsey. The Agricultural Department is fast-tracking state requests to yank soda and candy from food stamp programs. Arkansas and Indiana are among the first in line. Both states Tuesday said they were seeking clearance from the USDA to implement the changes, and Agricultural Secretary Brooke Rollins said her agency would move very, very quickly to approve them. "That's exactly the vision of making America healthy again," Rollins said. "I'm 100% certain that these changes will be nothing but positive for those underserved communities that are food challenged." Arkansas proposals to make candy and all types of soda ineligible for purchases under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, starting in July 2026. The policy changes would be a blow to Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and other soda makers, particularly if other states followed suit. Soda companies have lobbied hard against such changes. "Our goal is not to hurt any industry, but to support and promote healthier lifestyles," Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders said in an interview. "No one is saying you can't have a Diet Coke or a candy bar. We're saying you can't do it with taxpayer money." "Restricting soda from food stamp benefits won't make an ounce of difference in health," said American Beverage, an industry group representing Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and other soda makers. Christopher Gindlisberger, a spokesperson for the National Confectioners Association, called the restrictions misguided. "Consumers understand that chocolate and candy are treats, not meal replacements," he said. The Republican governors of West Virginia and Utah have said they plan to pursue similar restrictions in their food aid programs. Lawmakers in other states are working on legislation that would require their governors to do the same. Stripping soda and junk food out of the federal food aid program is a top priority for the Make America Healthy Again movement, led by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. Rollins sent governors a letter urging them to propose pilot programs that test changes to nutrition programs. President Trump himself drinks multiple Diet Cokes a day. Beverage company lobbyists had hoped to convince him not to support food stamp change by arguing that the restrictions would anger his core supporters. Write to Laura Cooper at laura.cooper@wsj.com. Christina Peterson at christina.peterson@wsj.com, and Josh Dowsey at josh.dowsey@wsj.com. U.S. plans to use tariff negotiations to isolate China. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent wants trading partners to limit China's involvement in their economies in exchange for concessions on reciprocal tariffs. By Gavin Bade and Brian Schwartz. The Trump administration plans to use ongoing tariff negotiations to pressure U.S. trading partners to limit their dealings with China. The idea is to extract commitments from the U.S. trading partners to isolate China's economy in exchange for reductions in trade and tariff barriers imposed by the White House. U.S. officials plan to use negotiations with more than 70 nations to ask them to disallow China to ship goods through their countries, prevent Chinese firms from locating on their territories to avoid U.S. tariffs, and not absorbing China's cheap industrial goods into their economies. Those measures are meant to put a dent in China's already rickety economy and force Beijing to the negotiating table with less leverage ahead of potential talks between Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping. The exact demands could vary widely by nation, given the degree of involvement with the Chinese economy. The White House and Treasury didn't respond to requests for comment. U.S. officials have broached the idea in early talks with some countries, people familiar with the discussions said. Trump himself hinted at the strategy on Tuesday, telling the Spanish-language program Fox Noticias he would consider making countries choose between the U.S. and China in response to a question about Panama deciding not to renew its role in the Belt and Road Initiative, China's global infrastructure program for developing nations. The brain behind the strategy is Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who has taken a leading role in the trade negotiations since Trump announced a 90-day pause on reciprocal tariffs for most nations, but not China, on April 9th. Bessent pitched the idea to Trump during the April 6th meeting at Mar-a-Lago, the president's club in Florida, said people familiar with the discussion, saying that extracting concessions from the U.S. trading partners could prevent Beijing and its companies from avoiding U.S. tariffs, export controls, and other economic measures. The tactic is part of a strategy being pushed by Bessent to isolate the Chinese economy that has gained traction among Trump officials recently. Debates over the scope and severity of U.S. tariffs are ongoing, but officials largely appear to agree with Bessent's China plan. It involves cutting China off from the U.S. economy with tariffs and potentially even cutting Chinese stocks out of U.S. exchanges. Bessent didn't rule out the administration trying to delist Chinese stocks in a recent interview with Fox Business. Still, the ultimate goal of the administration's China policy isn't yet clear. Bessent also said that there is still room for talks on a potential trade deal between the U.S. and China. Such talks would have to involve Trump and Xi. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt read a new statement from Trump during Tuesday's press briefing suggesting a deal with China isn't imminent. The ball is in China's court, Leavitt said, while reading Trump's statement. China needs to make a deal with us. We don't have to make a deal with them. China wants what we have, the American consumer. It also isn't clear that the anti-China line has entered with negotiations with all nations. Some countries haven't heard demands from U.S. negotiators related to China, although they acknowledge that negotiations remain in early stages. Many expect the Trump administration to raise China-related demands sooner or later. Bessent has shown his desire for anti-China pledges from U.S. trading partners before. In late February, he said that Mexico had offered to match U.S. tariffs on China as part of negotiations over Trump's tariffs on Mexico, imposed because of the fentanyl trade. Bessent called Mexico's offer a nice gesture, but the idea didn't find much traction with the administration. Since then, Bessent has taken a more central role in trade negotiations, assuming a lead in talks over reciprocal tariffs after Trump announced his 90-day pause on April 9th. The Treasury Secretary is slated to meet with Japan's Economic Revitalization Minister as soon as Wednesday and has laid out a list of nations he thinks could soon reach deals with the U.S., including Japan, the U.K., Australia, South Korea, and India. China is conducting its own trade diplomacy. This week, Xi traveled to Vietnam and signed dozens of economic pledges with the Hanoi government. China views Trump's reciprocal trade gambit as an opportunity. Peter Harrell, the former senior director for international economics and former President Joe Biden's National Security Council, said on a panel discussion Tuesday at Georgetown Law. But China's ability to counteract U.S. trade policies is limited, Harrell said. While the U.S. remains a massive net importer, China is reducing its imports from the rest of the world and focusing on self-sufficiency. China isn't going to replace the U.S. as a source of demand for the products that a bunch of these developing countries make, Harrell said. So the economics of this are going to prove challenging for China. But I think we see them playing the politics of this reasonably savvily. Write to Gavin Bade at gavin.bade@wsj.com and Brian Schwartz at brian.schwartz@wsj.com. Will Doge take a bite out of this spy firm's stock? That's classified. Secretive nature of Booz Allen's government work makes it nearly impossible for investors to gauge how cuts will affect the business. The stock pitch seemed too good to be true. A century-old company near Washington, D.C., with strong ties to the U.S. intelligence community, has secret ways of making money. The company is Booz Allen Hamilton, and for many years it has home-run investment. The stock rose tenfold between the day in 2013 when Edward Snowden made public as the former employee who leaked secret National Security Agency documents in last year's presidential election. Now Booz Allen is anything but a sure thing. Federal spending on consultants and large outside contractors is dropping fast under the Trump administration and Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Booz Allen's stock is down 40% since Election Day. The problem for investors, the nature of Booz Allen's business means it's impossible to gauge how severe the blow from federal cutbacks will be. While Booz Allen gets 98% of its revenue from the U.S. government, a substantial portion of its contracts are classified. This makes the stock almost uniquely uninvestable for anybody who wants to know what they own in today's environment. Investors seem to have cottoned on to this problem ahead of the Wall Street. Analysts' average revenue and earnings estimates for 2026 and beyond have barely budged since Election Day, according to data compiled by Visible Alpha. Maybe this is a belief that Booz Allen can navigate all the cost scrutiny it is under and stay deeply embedded in the government. But as the Wall Street Journal has reported previously, the company already has offered the government significant potential cost savings. At least management is transparent about how opaque it is. Because we are limited in our ability to provide information about these contracts and services, the company said in its most recent annual report, important information concerning our business may not be available, which may limit insight into a substantial portion of our business and reduce the ability to fully evaluate the risks related to that portion of our business. U.S. securities rules bar companies from including classified information in their disclosure filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Consequently, Booz Allen couldn't keep investors fully informed about its business even if it wanted to. When Booz Allen listed its top 10 contracts in its latest annual report, it said 8 of them were classified and couldn't be named. When it gave dollar amounts estimating the size of its total addressable market, it said it excluded U.S. intelligence agencies from the numbers. Other public companies have classified government contracts and do business with the intelligence community, of course, although not all of that is classified. Given this, one could reasonably argue that Booz Allen shouldn't be a public company because of a law. By law, it can't fulfill the normal disclosure duties of one. In its 110-year history, it has been public only since 2010. It used to be owned by the private equity firm Carlyle Group, which sold the last of its stake in 2016. Taking it private again could be a better option if there is a willing buyer. Absent that, Investors might rightly figure it's better to sell than to hold onto a black box investment. Write to Jonathan Wheel at jonathan.wheel@wsj.com. Porsche's heir's plan to build a private tunnel has his Alpine neighbors fuming. Deal to dig a car cave through the mountain to auto tycoon's 17th century villa is stoking a class war in Salzburg, a morally reprehensible project, by Stephen Wilmot. For the 1920s literary celebrity Stephen Zweig, part of the charm of his romantic and impractical Salzburg home was that it sat on an alpine foothill, inaccessible by car. For automotive tycoon Wolfgang Porsche, who bought the 17th century villa for roughly $9 million in 2020, the lack of easy access is an engineering problem with an expensive solution. A roughly 1,600-foot private tunnel through the hill to a cavernous underground garage. The question is whether Salzburg, the picture-perfect Austrian city, best known as the home of Mozart and the Sound of Music, will give its most notable current residents the green light. The extravagant car cave has become the talk of the town, reigniting debate over whether a municipality famous for its black tie opera festival has one rule for the rich and another for the rest. Doris Rookberg, one of Porsche's neighbors, is delighted that someone is renovating one of the city's most prominent properties. Salzburg is Salzburg because of very rich people built these buildings and we're all proud of it, she said. But with the city's already high cost of living climbing further, the tunnel has become a flashpoint for the political left. Micah Cyrus, who is campaigning for election for the student body of the local university, highlighted the contrast between Porsche's plan and rising rents. It's unacceptable to us that a super-rich person is using his political contacts and money for a morally reprehensible project, she said. Until recently, Porsche's plan was cruising for a fast lane. Early last year, the 81-year-old got permission from Salzburg former mayor, a member of the conservative Austrian People's Party, to hollow out a cross-shaped private garage for up to 12 cars underneath the Kapsenberg, a wooded mountain rising steeply from the right bank of the River Salzach to the city center and connect to his new home. To reach the subterranean garage, a tunnel would be bored through the local limestone from an existing municipal parking lot. But then Salzburg Council made an abrupt left turn, with the Communist Party of Austria channeling worries about the housing costs to take votes from the People's Party in elections that March. I think that what amazes people is that a private individual can dig into the mountain, said Ingeborg Haller, who leads the Green Party group on the town council and has spearheaded the opposition to the project. She also questioned the fee Porsche had paid the council for permission to burrow through its land, 40,000 euros, equivalent to roughly $44,000, the total cost of the project, which Porsche himself would cover, would be as much as 10 million euros. Following Haller's inquiry, Salzburg's new mayor commissioned an independent valuation. It concluded Porsche overpaid. The permission is worth 35. The villa is a local landmark, one of just a few buildings on the Kapsenberg, alongside the Capuchin Monastery that gives the area its name. The view, crowned by the snow-capped Alps at this time of year, is much photographed by the roughly 1.8 million visitors Salzburg gets annually. Zweig used to invite world-famous authors such as James Joyce and Thomas Mann to stay in the house. Zweig himself inspired Wes Anderson's 2014 hit film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, which channeled the Jewish writer's trademark nostalgia for the old Mitteleuropa that he witnessed succumb to Nazism. In the tunnel affair, one compromise could solve some public access to what is sometimes called the Villa Zweig. Another might be to open the tunnel to Rookberg and other occupiers of the hill, who, like Porsche, currently have to drive up a steep, winding road and through a couple of narrow historic gateways. Underground parking for Porsche's property would require a change to Salzburg's zoning plan and hence a council vote. This is expected to take place in mid-May. Mayor Bernard Anger and his Social Democrat colleagues, who have yet to take sides, will have the casting votes. They sit between right-wing factions who see no reason to block Porsche from carving out his garage, and the communists and Greens who argue the tunnel is an inappropriate use of public land. Making the politics messier, Anger used to sit in the board of Porsche's holding company as a labor representative. The mayor said he hadn't yet decided whether or not he needs to recuse himself from the vote. What appears to irk locals is that Porsche received such swift service from the previous municipal government, while public tunnel projects never got off the ground. When someone has money, the town springs into action. But when it comes to building out public transport, then everything is suddenly not easy at all. Nicole Makula, a Salzburg-based graphic designer, recently wrote on social media, "The Salzburg Villa, which is being refurbished, Porsche's family home, is a 600-year-old farm near Zell am See, an hour-and-a-half drive to the south. The property was bought by his grandfather, Ferdinand Porsche, who founded the family's business and designed what became of the VW Beetle for Adolf Hitler. A former barn is dedicated to a car collection numbering about 40 vehicles, including the 1993 Porsche 911 Turbo S in the family green, and a 1952 open-top roadster that was designed for the U.S. market. Porsche, who is chairman of a holding company that controls both the namesake car maker and Volkswagen, has said he enjoys taking his cars for early morning spins on the nearby switchbacks leading up to the Grossenglockner, Austria's highest peak. Plenty of locals sympathize with the octogenarian, decrying that what they see as a political circus. It's the politics of envy, said Hans-Peter Rietner, a retired bank manager. It's also embarrassing in Salzburg when there are serious and important problems to solve. Write to Stephen Wilmot at stephen.wilmot@wsj.com. And now for an opinion article by the editorial board. Donald Trump tries to run Harvard. Many of his demands on the school exceed his power under the Constitution. The Trump administration on Monday froze $2.2 billion in funds to Harvard after the university refused to surrender to its sweeping demands. There are good reasons to oppose this unprecedented attempt by government to micromanage a private university. Stipulate that the feds have a duty to enforce civil rights laws, and Harvard failed to protect Jewish students during anti-Israel protests. But the university agreed to strengthen protections for Jewish students in a legal settlement with Students Against Anti-Semitism, which praised it for implementing effective long-term changes. The Trump administration, nonetheless, demanded last week that Harvard accede to what is effectively a federal receivership under the threat of losing $9 billion. Some of the demands are within the government's civil rights purview, such as requiring Harvard to discipline students who violate its discrimination policies. It also wants Harvard to shutter all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs under whatever name that violate federal law. But the administration runs off the legal rails by ordering Harvard to reduce governance bloat, duplication, or decentralization. It also orders the school to review all existing and prospective faculty for plagiarism, and ensure viewpoint diversity in each department, field, or teaching unit. These reforms may be worth pursuing, but the government has no business requiring them. Its biggest overreach is requiring viewpoint diversity, which it doesn't define. Does this mean the English department must hire more Republican faculty or Shakespeare scholars? An internal monitor will decide such questions. If the monitor finds insufficient diversity, however, defined, the university must hire a critical mass of new faculty within that department or field who will provide that diversity and admit critical mass of students to provide the same. Must Harvard ask applicants if they support Mr. Trump and impose ideological quotas on hiring and admissions? Harvard is bound by the High Court Students for Fair Admissions precedent 2023, which prohibits racial preferences in admissions. The administration offers no evidence that Harvard is violating the law, but intends a fishing expedition to prove it is. It demands to audit Harvard's hiring and admissions data and publish admissions rates disaggregated by race, GPA, and test scores. Is the aim to use disparate impact analysis, a favorite tool of the left, to tag Harvard with discrimination? Even race-neutral policies, such as admitting more students from low-income schools, might result in racially disparate outcomes. At least the Biden and Obama administrations did investigations before bringing down the Title I-X hammer. The Trump team is shooting first and investigating later. In a better world, Harvard and all colleges would be less dependent on Washington for money. But Republicans can't seem to muster the courage to reform the student loan program, such as capping graduate loans, which would force universities to shrink administrative bloat and polarize departments. In any case, much of the federal money Harvard receives supports medical research in affiliated hospitals, including Boston Children's. Harvard could fund some, though not all, of such research within its $53 billion endowment, but there are sure to be casualties from the administration's hostage-taking, including perhaps cancer patients. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the government may not use federal benefits or funds to coerce parties to surrender their constitutional rights. This is what the administration is doing by demanding Harvard accede to viewpoint diversity. The administration is also overstepping its authority by imposing sweeping conditions on funds that weren't spelled out by Congress. The justices held in Cummings 2022 that if Congress intends to impose a condition on the grant of federal monies, it must do so unambiguously to ensure the recipient voluntarily and knowingly accepted the terms. Congress can pass a law to advance Mr. Trump's higher ed reforms, such as reporting admissions data, but the administration can't unilaterally and retroactively attach strings to grants that are unrelated to their purpose. President Trump has enough balls in the air without also trying to run Harvard. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.